This is an AMI podcast. This is an AMI podcast.
I'm Kelly McDonald.
I'm Ramya Muthan, and you're about to embark on the complete Kelly and Company podcast experience.
It's full octane Kelly and Ramya with all the fixins.
Live from the Accessible Media Studios, this is Kelly and Company. Entertainment, lifestyle, and great conversation. It's AMI Audio's on-air community, and everyone's invited. And now, the big man himself, Kelly McDonald.
Wow, lots of stuff today on the program, folks. So thank you for settling in with us. We're going to get started in just a moment, but let's take care of the things that we have to do. The business at hand. Ramya Muthan, speaking of business at hand, how are you?
Hello. I'm doing well. How are you?
All right. Well, today we get to talk about our book of the month. We get to promote the next book of the month. It's a Tuesday. It seems like an earlier Tuesday because February ends next weekend. It seems like we're already on the book, got another one lined up. And all that gets kind of exciting, right? When you start thinking about that, the great conversations we'll have with that. And what I love about the book club, I will say, is our level of honesty. And again, it's one thing to like or not like a book, but it's another thing too to comment on our narrators and other things about it. And no offense to any narrator we like or don't like, but it's nice to be able to have that extra element when talking audiobooks to mention.
Exactly. And I've become, I should say, you know, more versatile when it comes to commenting on books, because as you said, it's one thing to like or not like the book, but that used to be the kind of extent as to how far I'd go in reading a book or finishing a book. And, you know, you and Ryan were talking about the other day, it takes a lot for you not to finish a book, right? But for me, it was very easy. Just kind of flip through, and if I didn't like it, nope, toss it. So many unfinished books in my Audible account. But I think that having this kind of regular, I don't want to say discipline, but this regular meeting once a month here on Kelly Co., as well as with Amir Khan in the Evening Book Club, is this really great way to discuss with other people, even books that you don't like, because you get to hear a lot of interesting perspectives and what the book means or how it sat for different people.
Yeah. And I think on how to separate your personal, you know, it's one thing when someone says, is it a good book? Well, it may not be a good book, the type you like to read. Doesn't mean take anything away from it for somebody else who might be interested in that kind of book. And I think that's one of the tricks too. And again, folks, we're not going to sit here and tell you, oh, try to sell a book on you. If I don't like it, I'm going to tell you, or if I really struggled with it or felt I didn't take away, I have no problem with admitting that. That's okay. It's preference. Doesn't mean someone else might not pick that thing up and whip through it and say, that's the best thing I've ever read. So I think that's been one of the fun things about doing a book club. But ahead of that, we've got a whole bunch of things on the program. Let's take a look for you. Wellness contributor Francis Wong tells us all about the fun world of float tanks. Wow, cool. Going to be fun.
Yes. How will we work in 2030? Which skills, tools, innovations, and ideas could change our lives? A new report compares and explains the biggest trends driving Canada's labor market in the decade ahead, and we're going to learn more about it with one of the authors.
Some fun activities out there, folks. Nova Scotia's first blind tennis club will participate in a blind-friendly tennis challenge. Community reporter Julie Martin has all the highlights for us. We'll talk to her at the top of hour two right here on Kelly and Company. Balance, our good friends over there, have something interesting going on tomorrow, so you might want to listen up in case this is something you want to jump into. Join them this Wednesday for a presentation that will explore practical ways to keep yourself and your loved ones safe. This webinar will provide essential tips and tricks for home safety and independence. How to adapt home safety techniques to be accessible to all abilities and connect with community members, balance staff and students in a welcoming environment. Topics include kitchen, bathroom, and overall home safety, as well as how to keep safe, and this is a big one, ladies and gentlemen, when inviting workers into your home. You don't have to be a balance client to join this. All are welcome. This presentation will be facilitated by occupational therapy students from Centennial College, along with a trained OT. An informational handout will also be provided after the seminar. The presentation will run tomorrow. That's Wednesday, February 24th, from 2:30 till 4 p.m. Eastern time. It'll be held via Zoom, as almost everything is nowadays. For any questions, email info@balancefba.org or call 416-236-1796, extension 0. All the answers can be provided for you there. So if you're interested, do check it out. Again, you do not have to be a Balance member. Let's check voicemails from Michael Babcock.
Hey, it is Michael Babcock. I would like to add my vote to the fact that Rumia's puppy should have, if not his own segment on the show, but at least the ability to make a presentation, or don't leave him out of the room. I mean, the world needs to hear from your puppy.
So I was thinking this over, and I think I found one of two roles for your puppy. As we were discussing, Rumia has now banished him from, well, generally, he worked his way in one day for affection moments and stuff like that. But
yeah,
he generally has his butt against the door of the home studio there, so she can't necessarily, she has to navigate out carefully when she makes a run for snacks. Anyway, two things here. So Michael sent that in. We could use him as a commentary for one of Michael's segments. You know, when Michael shifts gears or something, or he agrees, you know, we could get one of those barks. If you could maybe procure a couple of barks or find a way to give him that kind of little touch, and he knows, you know, give that bassy bark of his.
Got it.
Or
you teach him how to speak. Yep.
Yeah. Or when we have the committee reporters or Jim Crisco or any of the gang come on here to give one of their regional content reports, maybe even Billy, when he switches items, when they say, okay, Bill, what's your next time?
Woof.
You know, it'd almost be like a page turner.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, the second one, you know, it could work. We might have to do some pre-recording for that. I'm just wondering if it might be too late.
Well, he's like you, he sleeps, right, all the time.
Yeah,
so,
you got to wake him up. And then,
yeah.
And then you have to tempt him like you tempt me with snacks, right? You have to tempt him with something.
Oh, that gets too expensive, man, if we need him to work every day like that. Yeah.
I know. It could get pretty hefty.
It gets huge.
A big bill. Yeah.
Oh,
but I do like the first idea.
You do like that, eh? I like the idea because Babcock just kind of like put his hand up and said, pick me. Oh, Mr. Cotter. So, and I kind of like that. So I think that that's the best way. I want to talk about NASA now for a moment. The Mars rover isn't just transmitting images and video, but it's sending back, and this is a big one for us, audio as well.
That is the sound of wind on Mars, recorded by microphones on the Perseverance rover and courtesy NASA and the Jet Propulsion Laboratory at Caltech. And while alone, it's hardly as striking as the landscapes we've been seeing. The head of the entry and descent camera team, Dave Gruhl, says it's still pretty amazing.
Just imagine yourself sitting on the surface of Mars and listening to the surroundings. So that gentle whirl that happens in the background, that is a noise made by the rover.
And Gruhl explains that whir is important too, something engineers keeping the mission going can use.
To basically detect the health of moving systems, gears and actuators and things like that.
I'm Ben Thomas.
You can see some of that on YouTube. I always look to see what NASA's got, and somebody's, I don't know if that's the video, giving its own sound. At first, that sound of the wind, I thought it was you messing with your microphone. I was like, oh, what's she doing? And I realized, that is the sound. Rum, for us, really huge because I remember trying to go online and, I wish I could see these videos of stuff, putting my face against the screen when I had better vision to see stuff. But now, for the first time, audio for some of us to feel a part of that.
I know. And then the imagery of imagine yourself sitting on the surface of Mars listening to that, that is exactly what I felt like I was doing. Huge. And I love that science behind why it's good to hear the sound of the actual craft as well. Wow. This is fascinating stuff.
They say that if you were whistled up there, you wouldn't really hear it. Your voice would sound a little muffled based on the way things are up there. So I thought that was really kind of cool. We're going to take a break, everyone. It is a Tuesday edition of Kelly and Company. So coming up next, how are our pets affected if someone in our household was unfortunate enough to come down with COVID-19? Well, veterinarian Danielle Johnkine is going to weigh in on this question and give us an idea because unfortunately it's very common these days. We'll take a break and talk to her right after this here on Kelly and Company. The past year has been a bit of a struggle, ladies and gentlemen. We've all felt both direct and indirect impacts of that pandemic we were talking about just a little while ago. And the COVID fatigue, it's real. That's why our team of contributors are digging up ways to improve mental health and resilience to the pandemic's constant changes. So please stick with us, ladies and gentlemen, for a daily dose of Zen from Kelly & Company. Kelly McDonald here, host of the program with Ramya Muthan.
On Tuesdays, we like to check in with our veterinarian, Danielle Jeankind.
The human-animal bond plays such an important role in people's lives, and as a veterinarian, it's my privilege to help keep those bonds strong and healthy. I'm Dr. Danielle Jeankind, and welcome to Ask a Veterinarian.
Danielle, we are having a bit of a discussion, a back and forth, if you will, about whether Glizzy, my dog, should be in the studio during shows or not, because he's been pretty vocal lately. But we're saying we might be able to put that on a demand thing where, you know, he speaks on demand or on command, and then we can use that in the show. And then other times he can just be quiet. What are your thoughts? I think a little training can go a long way.
I think Danielle's going to say, you got a big job. Get to work.
I know.
Well, I can tell you, you actually can teach your dog to speak on command. I did that with a husky I had many years ago, and he would never bark. He would just go, rawr, 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 like he had this sort of half howl, half bark thing going right. on. So whenever, and there were certain times when I would just know that he was going to do it, you know? And so right before he started to do it, I would say, Joey, sing. And then I'd reward him with a treat when he actually made any noise. And so it didn't take him long to figure out that if I said, Joey, sing, if he wanted a cookie, he should sing, right?
Nice.
So it was actually pretty easy to teach. The harder part was getting him to stop.
Exactly.
Because he, you know, once he got going, he was like, this is great. There was no off switch. A little bit
yes.
harder.
And sometimes yeah, you got to get to them right away to ask them to sing, unless they start singing without you. Then you're like, oh no, they're doing it without the cookie.
That's right. That's right. And then, but there is actually a way to teach the no bark command too, you know, which is rewarding them for, you know, being quiet after
my
you,
favorite.
You know, give them the command. Yeah.
Somehow I think that one's a little harder.
Yes. Yeah, it's a little harder to intuitively get them to stop. You have to wait for them to stop and then reward them. and then they get the idea.
See, we get little tips and tricks with you along the way. Danielle, in our current circumstance for today's subject, the coronavirus has turned the world as we know it upside down. And we're wondering if it's changed the collective behavior towards us and our pets. And are there things that we need to know to keep our pets safe if someone in our household comes down with COVID-19, for example? And we did discuss bits of this earlier on in the pandemic, but you're going to weigh in on some of these questions as you give us an update to pets and the pandemic. So to start things off, do we have any new scientific information on COVID-19 and if it can infect animals?
Well, that's definitely an area that's still being looked at. We know that the SARS-CoV-2 virus can infect cats, dogs, ferrets, and mink. We know that dogs don't usually get sick with it. If cats do get sick with it, the disease is usually mild. We know now that cats can shed the virus after infection for a short period of time, and that they can infect other cats with it. A few newer studies have shown some new and interesting information. Researchers have determined that some cats who were infected with the virus once and then recovered can become reinfected again. And I think they've seen that in a few people as well. They were also able to show that those cats had less illness the second time around, and that they weren't able to transmit the virus to other cats the second time around either, which I thought was pretty cool, actually. Even more interesting research looked at what different species of animals were able to be infected with the virus. So apparently camels, horses, sheep, cows, and rabbits can theoretically become infected with the virus, but ducks, pigs, chickens, and guinea pigs cannot. And, you know, because, you know, we live with urban wildlife and wildlife around, you know, and in our cities, like coyotes and raccoons and, you know, birds and such, some studies have even been done on wildlife. So some scientists went out and caught a few individuals of different species of wildlife and exposed them to COVID-19. And they found that some of them actually can be infected with the virus and shed it, even though they don't get sick. So they found the animals that could do that were skunks, deer mice, and bushy-tailed wood rats. I have no idea what a bushy-tailed wood rat is, but, you know, apparently they must be hanging around out there somewhere. Other wild animals weren't susceptible to the virus. So raccoons, house mice, and cottontail rabbits. And, you know, and I felt a little better about that just because, you know, I mean, typically raccoons and house mice are two of the more common things that people come in contact with as far as wild animals go.
Wow. And you think about that. Wow. It, because, you know, we all, oh, cats, dogs, and things like that. But as you mentioned, you know, a lot of us, unfortunately, will get a mouse in the house. And you don't need to know, have that. It's bad enough all the other things off the surface. So that's kind of interesting. We're also hearing in the news about the new variances of the coronavirus causing all kinds of problems. Do we know if they will affect pets any differently?
We don't know at this point. Theoretically, mutations in the virus could make it less infectious toward other species, or it could become more infectious towards other species. It really depends on, you know, the mutation that is, you know, expressing on the surface of the virus. But the more individuals a virus infects, whether those individuals be animals or humans, the more likely it is to mutate. So really, to protect ourselves and our pets from the threat of the virus mutating, the best thing we can do right now is to prevent ourselves from becoming infected. So nothing really has changed on that front. You know, to protect yourself and your pets, it's best to keep yourself and your pets away from infected people.
Do we know yet, Danielle, if COVID-19 can be transmitted from humans, or sorry, animals to people? Because this was another question.
Yeah, and it's sort of an interesting question because, you know, more specifically, people want to know, you know, what animals, you know, can I get right. it from my pets? Can I get it from my neighbor's dog on the street? Is it only wild animals I can get it from, you know? So the official word from organizations like the World Health Organization is that there is no evidence supporting the transmission of COVID-19 from companion animals to people. The CDC's website says that there have been documented cases of infection in pets, but that the risk of becoming infected by a pet is low. But there was one study published in the journal Science in January of this year that showed that mink farm workers in the Netherlands had contracted the virus from the mink they worked with. And so the mink originally caught it from the farm workers, passed it around to each other, and then other farm workers, you know, were able to pick it up from the mink. So in spite of the fact that, you know, pets can both carry and shed the virus, there's never been a documented case of someone catching COVID from a pet. And basically, all we can really conclude right now is that there is a theoretical risk, you know, which is probably low, and we need to do more research on it. And I mean, University of Guelph researchers are looking at, you know, these questions and stuff. So hopefully, you know, we'll have more answers in the coming months.
Well, I know a lot of our friends with service animals, that's the big thing, of course, they're concerned due to the relationship. I know a lot of people play with their animals and do things like that, but that constant relationship that someone with a service animal, guide dog, whatever it might be, these are some of the worries. So have the recommendations for handling pets in the home with infected people changed in regards to pets?
No, you know, and it's important to remember, just to remember to treat pets, you know, as if they're people with respect to coronavirus transmission. So, you know, if you're infected with coronavirus, you know, you wouldn't have unnecessary or close contact with people, with any people, like even people in your own household. So you should apply those same principles to your pet. So, you know, obviously, if you get sick with coronavirus, you know, you should have someone else in the house who should be looking after your pet. If you're quarantining in your bedroom, you know, you don't want your pet to come in and sleep with you, that sort of thing, you know. Don't let pets interact with people outside your household and practice physical distancing from other people's pets. And, you know, that's harder than you think. I mean, you think you're going to go out for a walk with your dog and your dog's buddy lives down the street, but it's the same principle. You know, you don't go over to your buddy's house for coffee right now, so you don't let your dog socialize either. You know, if your pet, if you're in quarantine, your pet should be quarantined as well. And, you know, I think the big thing to realize, you know, is that there's no need to panic over potential animal exposure to COVID-19, because if your pet is infected with that virus, it probably caught it from you, you know, and the good news is that they're not likely to get very sick with it.
Danielle, are there any benefits, beneficial effects that you want to talk about for having pets during the pandemic?
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, this has been such a great thing, you know, to hear the lead in to the segment today about how, you know, your contributors are coming with these little rays of sunshine, because, you know, pets are definitely a ray of sunshine during the pandemic. And actually, the Human Animal Bond Research Institute has been looking at the beneficial effects of pets during the pandemic. So they went out and they did a bunch of surveys and they gave them out to pet owners. And when they got them back, they realized that there were some really amazing benefits to having a pet through the pandemic. So 72% of surveyed pet owners reported that their pet helps to reduce their stress and anxiety through the pandemic. Also, caring for pets helps people keep a schedule and routine and gives them a sense of purpose. You know, so if you're isolating or working from home, you know, and you have to get out of bed in the morning to feed your cat, you know, these are reasons to get out of bed in the morning and keep going with a routine. And I mean, really, try skipping your cat's morning meal during the lockdown and see why it's a good idea to get out of bed. I mean, my cat would be breaking down my door.
I was just going to say, the cat can hunt you down pretty easy. It's not like you're out, like, I'm out of here, cat. You know, I'm going to work now.
Exactly. And, you know, and they say like 73% of pet owners, you know, are exercising more than usual and they're out walking their dogs more. And, you know, 70% of dog owners reported their dogs reduced their feelings of loneliness and isolation. And, you know, I think that's a really fantastic thing. And some of these benefits even work in reverse, in that our pets seem to be getting some benefits out of the pandemic, in that 84% of pet owners reported that they're now more aware of their pet's health because of the pandemic.
That's nice. That's great. So with that being said, do you think people visit the veterinarian more because of this?
I think that's the case here, like in Ontario, maybe the rest of Canada. I'm not as certain about the other provinces, but from my own experience, my own personal experience, I can tell you that we are really busy at work. And, you know, we are seeing a lot of new puppies and kittens compared to what we've seen at this time of year in the past years before the pandemic. And, you know, even the Canadian Veterinary Medical Association website reported that vet services are booming, you know, and especially in the U.S. and Australia in particular. I couldn't really find any specific information about Canada, but I feel that, you know, that's probably the case here as well.
Mm-hmm. Danielle, this is amazing. Next week, we're going to talk about something that we remind ourselves of and our friends and family. But is it important to pay attention to how much water our pets are drinking? Really interesting and probably very important subject. We'll talk to you then.
Okay, you guys have a good week.
You too. Danielle Jeankind is our veterinarian, and she joins us every Tuesday for Ask a Vet.
Francis Wong on deck next to talk float tanks, ladies and gentlemen. Let's immerse ourselves in that topic in a moment. When on Facebook, check out the Accessible Media Inc. Facebook page. Wouldn't mind if you liked it. There's lots of great content up there. If you want to reach out to Ramya, she's at AllRams on Twitter. I'm at AMI Kelly Mac. Love to hear from you. It's time, ladies and gentlemen, as we return to Kelly and Company, Ramya Muth and Kelly McDonald, hosts of the program, to have our wellness segment. And we invite in Francis Wong.
Hello, I'm Francis Wong, and I invite you to join me as we explore topics of health and wellness so that you can make the best choices for you to live an informed and radiant life.
Well, today Francis has a really fun topic for it. Well, and again, when I say that, I just close my eyes and think, oh, wow, how relaxing. But I don't know a lot about this. So let's bring Francis in and have this conversation here. We're talking all about the fun world of float tanks and potentially getting a vacation feel during this time of lockdown. Francis, welcome back. And this sounds so intriguing. How do you want to start?
Sure. I just thought that this would be a great topic because, you know, when we're in isolation, self-isolation during COVID, it might seem counterintuitive to go and isolate ourselves further. But this is a way to have like a mini escape and a way to be able to pamper ourselves when spa services, saunas, and pools may not be open in your area. Or if you live in a household with a lot of people in a small space and you need some me time, it might be nice to get away from it all by just visiting a float center.
Yeah, no kidding. I was laughing when you said we've been isolated and now we want to isolate ourselves further. But yeah, if you're stuck living with your family for like a year and you literally have not left the house for maybe a handful of times, then you're probably thinking this is an amazing idea.
I'm tired of you guys. I'm going to the float tank.
Honestly. Yeah. So tell us what these float tanks are.
Sure. So float tanks have many names and are sometimes called sensory deprivation or immersion therapy tanks or isolation baths. And my favorite is dream pods. The idea is that the person enters an enclosed tank filled with Epsom salt water and floats on their back for the duration of the session. And then the person comes out relaxed and refreshed. But in reality, the experience, of course, is going to vary from person to person, but there is a science behind this.
So how did this become a thing?
I'm glad you asked. So the history of this invention goes back to 1954 by an American neuropsychiatrist and doctor by the name of John Lilly. He was studying the brain and consciousness and invented the first isolation tank. The point was to isolate the brain from external stimulation through something called REST, which stands for Restricted Environmental Stimulation Technique.
Well, that sounds really interesting. So how does that, because I'm assuming from the 1950s to now, things have changed a little bit. So how does the first version of the float tank compare to today's?
Let's say that it's a good thing that they don't do it the same way as the early days, because it actually sounds a bit barbaric and claustrophobic the way that they did things before. So Dr. Lilly filled a tank with ocean water and then submerged his study participants in the water in an upright position in a diving suit with a face mask painted black to block out all light. And then they also wore super tight fitting and uncomfortable neoprene clothing and were hooked up to an oxygen tank, which would make hissing sounds, so it wasn't completely free of noise. And then because they were not able to see, they needed assistance going in and out of the tank. So I think today's standard by far would be considered a luxury.
Good grief. You wouldn't even know what you're going into. It'd just be like, all right, we're going to relax you. It's not relaxing. Help me. How did they feel coming out of the tank?
So actually, their answer was what prompted Dr. Lilly to research this further. Surprisingly, they were feeling calm and relaxed, even after being in what appears to be awkward and uncomfortable gear. So it seems that the absence of external stimuli allows the brain to free up resources to have more clarity. So the left side of the brain is the one we use for day-to-day logical thinking and processing, and the right side is for the creative aspects. When we are awake and alert, we are in beta brainwaves, which are quite fast. In the absence of stimuli, the brainwaves slow down and we can shift into alpha waves, which are slower and translate to a more relaxed and calm state. Or we can drop even further into a deeper relaxation called theta waves, which is where meditation and mental imagery begins. And then if you're super relaxed, you may even shift into delta waves, which is the deep, dreamless sleep state. So what can happen is someone in the isolation tank may move from a very active brain to one that is much more quiet and calm because of the lack of stimulation.
Okay, I genuinely didn't think that it was going to be that deep. I thought maybe they just liked the feeling of floating around. I don't know. But okay, so the senses, this is, you know, incredibly unique, it feels like, to be able to go from especially the worlds that we live in right now to this float tank scenario. How are the senses really affected?
Well, for your sight, the tank is closed, so it's dark. And then for your hearing, you're wearing earplugs to keep the salt water out, but also to help reduce noise. For smell, there's no chlorine in the water, so there isn't really any smell. And taste-wise, you're not drinking the water. And then for touch, the air and the water are the same temperature as the skin. And the feeling of a boundary of the body fades so that you can't really tell where your body stops and the water begins. And of course, you feel like you're floating, which you really are.
Hmm. Are there any benefits to the floating part?
Yeah, so we just talked about the mental benefits with the brain and relaxation, but there are physical benefits as well to the body. The Epsom salt that is used in the tanks is actually magnesium sulfate, which has a natural healing effect on the body. Magnesium is something that humans need, and when we soak in the water for so long, we can absorb this magnesium, which is known to help with decreasing inflammation in the body. So it may help relieve some pain if you have arthritis or any muscle aches. I also noticed that my skin felt smooth like a baby after my sessions, thanks to the salt, and I have actually fallen asleep in some of my floats as well and come out super relaxed.
So you've done this a few times.
Yes, I have.
Oh, that's awesome. Okay. Well, it sounds really great. I think I'd really love it too. But the first thing that jumps to mind, especially at this time, but not necessarily just because of it, is cleanliness, right? So even during non-COVID times, cleanliness is probably going to be a huge factor. But like I said, especially now.
Right. That was definitely one of my first concerns when I started looking into flotation therapy. There are several factors that need to be considered. The tanks are required to always be cleaned with the maintenance of the volume of water, hydrogen peroxide, salt concentration, and pH. So there are three ways that they keep the tanks clean. First, we start with the amount of Epsom salt in each tank. So I'm going to ask you if you want to take a guess how many pounds of Epsom salt there are.
I don't know. It's pretty expensive.
Mm-hmm. Well, that would be my one.
Pounds?
Like, wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, what did you say, Ramya?
5 pounds-ish.
Kelly, do you have a guess?
No. I wouldn't even want to hazard one. It'd be ridiculous.
Because if it's too much salt, then it's not going to melt, right? Or
it's the salt that allows you to float. So 5 pounds would not let you float.
You'd have to have like 100, wouldn't you?
Oh, geez.
It's actually 1,000 pounds.
Oh, my goodness.
1,000 pounds.
Gosh.
Yes. So they put 1,000 pounds of
I wouldn't have been ridiculous.
In 10.5 inches of water, or about 26 centimeters. So that works out to be a salt concentration of about 35%. Otherwise, you would not be able to float at all.
Only 35%?
Yes, yes. So even no matter your weight, you'll be able to float. So secondly, the water goes through 4 to 5 rounds of filtration through a 10-micron cartridge filter, which is small enough to catch impurities that are half the size of a human hair. And lastly, the filtration system has UV light penetration and 50 to 100 parts per million of hydrogen peroxide.
Wow. Oh, I just find that, like, what they've learned, it's just phenomenal to do this. So let's go back to the original tanks. When you talk about the tank itself, what are they like? I mean, what if you're claustrophobic?
So it's way more comfortable now because you're lying on your back and floating and free of anything touching your skin. No restricting face mask, no tight diving suit, no oxygen tank. And you control whether you want it to be lit up softly inside or completely dark, and whether you want music or silence. It's very spa-like, like being cocooned. And you know, like in the old days, we had the CD Walkman players where you can press a button and the top will lift up a little bit so that you can slide your CD in, and then it's like a clamshell and you can kind of close the lid. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing here. You do the same thing inside. Once you step inside, you close the lid as much as you want. But I recommend closing it completely so that the warm air inside the tank doesn't escape. And then some places even have open tubs with no lids, like an open bathtub, so that you can float in if you're claustrophobic.
Okay, yeah. So it is pretty flexible in your experience and what you want it to be. But how about for people with disabilities? Anything specific there?
Yeah, so if someone is visually impaired, they can still use the isolation tanks if they have someone that can assist them to get in and out of the tank. It's probably best to check with the flotation center, but I'm sure they wouldn't have an issue with that. And then some places also have large enough tanks or cabins to allow for tandem floats. So if you have a loved one, they can help guide you into place and float with you at the same time.
Hmm. Oh, man.
I'm curious on the length. This is the thing that's kind of been puzzling me about, like, how long are the sessions and what do you have to bring to be able to go into one of these?
Yeah, so you will have your regular clothes and the spa will have a shower with shampoo and body wash, and they will usually provide you with earplugs as well. And while you can wear a swimsuit if you prefer, I suggest that you don't, so that the fabric of the suit isn't creating friction against your body. The private room is yours for the duration, and you can even lock it before you get into the tank. And then the floats themselves are usually a minimum of 60 minutes, but they add 15 minutes before and after the float so that you have time to change and rinse off before you get into the tank, and then to clean up and shower after the float.
So sorry, just to confirm, you're saying it's better with a swimsuit on, or it's better with like your regular clothes on?
No. You bring your clothes. Off. You can bring the swimsuit. You wear nothing.
Oh, okay. Don't wear clothes.
Don't wear anything. Yeah.
Lady, nice here. Nice salted clothing. Looks great.
I missed the third option. Got it. Thanks. Okay, so how widespread is this flotation therapy now? I know I've seen it in a few different references, like on TV and stuff, but I'm curious, are a lot of people doing it?
Yeah, so float tanks have become popular again starting in 2010 onwards as people have begun to rediscover the benefits of this therapy. There are many float centers throughout Canada and the US, but you can also find them all the way in the UK, Australia, South Africa, and even in Thailand. So they're mostly in larger cities since the cost of running the tanks is high. So if there isn't one close to you and you're up for an adventure, you can always add it to your bucket list or itinerary as an excursion to do while you're traveling. So it's like an escape while you're on an escape.
I would imagine you could get pretty addicted to it if you had the means, one near you or whatever, if it worked out for you, if you didn't have any fear of being in there in any capacity. It sounds like, Frances, something that you've enjoyed.
Yeah, I have. It's great. I think it takes a couple of times to go just to kind of settle in let your body adjust, but it's been great.
Awesome. Thanks a lot. Really good topic. Really interesting to learn about it, Frances, and to kind of experience through you, but also that information. I will say, though, the 1954 version, definitely not too interested in that one. That just sounds like a total.
It does not sound like Zen at all.
Yeah, exactly. That sounds more like just something to scare the heck out of you. I don't know how long it would take for me to get used to that one. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Next time, we're going to cover off the importance of sleep when Frances joins us. She joins us bi-weekly here on Kelly & Company, opposite our nutrition segment with Julia Karanchis. Coming up next, folks, how we work in 2030, what skills, tools, innovations, and ideas could change our lives. A new report explains the biggest trends driving our labor market. We'll get into that ahead in just a moment. So are you going shopping tonight, Rum?
What, my bathing suit?
No.
Oh.
You said clothes or anything in there, so I figure you're going to go buy a salt-proof suit to go and wear.
Well, I don't know. I have to tell you, the context is I've done whitewater rafting, right? And it's a full-on wetsuit, like hands, toes, everything. So I thought maybe there might be some other option.
Not really sure what the similarity between a float tank, unless you dump the float tank into the water, into the rapids and went. And then you'd have a float tank to hopefully keep you safe.
Okay. All right. I've embarrassed myself. It's fine.
Ma'am, would you like to go in here and try this salt-proof suit on? Welcome, folks. It's Kelly & Company. Rub your booth at Kelly McDonald, host of the show. Please remember, we do have the Kelly & Company podcast. Subscribe and download it at your convenience in case you can't be with us for the 2 o'clock performance. As you see on the program here, weekdays or any of our repeats, 5 midnight, 5 a.m. in the morning Eastern time. You can listen to the segment or the show completely parceled out on, on its own, or the whole show itself, where we had an audio vanity card today provided by Jeff Ryman, and we hear the adventures of Jeff and the new cat. So it's going to be good. Nice. Ramya Muthan, Kelly McDonald, host of the show.
We're going to look into the future a little bit, at least in the next 10 years, because how will we be working? That's the question. In 2030, which skills, tools, innovations, and ideas could change our lives? Well, there's a new report that explains the biggest trends driving Canada's labor market in the next decade. And one of the reports, we're going to talk about it today with the report, we're going to talk to one of the report's lead authors, Heather Rasik. Heather, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we're really curious and excited, hopefully, with the implications. Can you tell us a little bit about what this report is about and why you started it?
For sure. So I work at a place called the Brookfield Institute for Innovation and Entrepreneurship, and we're actually working on a project right now where we're trying to work with different organizations in different parts of the countries to help create some new services or interventions to actually help people prepare for the future of work. And as part of that, at the beginning of the project, we really did want to try and understand a little bit better how the pandemic has impacted the future of work in Canada so that we could take that into consideration as we design new programs. So this report we released actually just tries to summarize some, there's many more, but some of the changes that have happened as a result of the pandemic that we should maybe pay attention to going forward.
I find it very interesting, some of the conversations that I've had with people, especially on workplaces, as we see, hey, when are we returning to the office, that kind of thing. And it's really just ongoing. And you just hear the changes that people come up with and hey, how does this affect? And, you know, kind of wanting that reinforcement that, hey, you mean when we come out of this, when things are semi-normal, when things are back to normal, what will it look like? So how long, with curtailing this kind of information and gathering it, how long have you guys been working on it?
So we started doing the research in the fall. So we really spent about 3 or 4 months doing some research and trying to synthesize what we were learning into this report that we just released a few weeks ago. And what I guess I would like to point out is so much is changing right now and so fast. So it
yes.
even feels like,
yeah.
you know, it's already a little bit out of date in the sense that things are still emerging and still changing all the time.
Well, and when you started September, you're still looking at, okay, we started into this thing last February, March. Do we have enough time? We've gathered a few things, everybody doing this and that. But then, as you say, it goes September to now, and what we thought in September has already changed. So I can understand that.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us about, Heather, these 8 mega trends that you highlighted in this report.
For sure. So what we did to do this research actually is to look for signals of change or kind of little pieces of information that, you know, maybe isn't mainstream yet, but that is telling us something. So it could be a tweet someone put out. It could be a patent. It could be a piece of artwork. It's actually a lot of different sources that we look at. And when we were organizing all of those pieces of information into themes, we ended up finding that there were kind of these 8 main themes that we were talking about as a team. And so those really range from, you know, there's a theme called Our Lives Online, where we talk a lot about remote work and digital leisure and how much is happening remotely right now. But there's other themes like capitalism in question and technology to the rescue and climate in crisis, which are also other themes that we wanted to pay attention to beyond just the conversation about remote work.
Mm. You, feel free to mention any of the others if there's any particular highlighted one you want to kind of note, because it's interesting when you say that you guys wanted to pay attention to specific ones as you sat around figuring what needs to be addressed. And maybe you can talk to us about the process that made you guys decide these are the areas to really look at, or how much of that time was, what do you think? What have you found? Let's see what we're going to focus on more to derive these 8.
Right. The other, so I mentioned 4 already. The other 4 are reconciliation and inclusion, finding meaning and well-being, shifting power, and evolving population. And really it was more of a kind of a ground up way to identify these themes. We actually did all of the work to think about some of the sub changes that we talk about in the report. And then based on that, we just found that they really kind of group themselves in a way into these themes. And we did really try to balance all of these themes. So we didn't, you know, we have some changes that we talk about related to technology, but we didn't only want to talk about technology.
Right.
We also really wanted to pay attention to kind of what has been happening over the last year in terms of awareness around anti-racism and reconciliation. So we did really try to pay attention and balance it so that it wasn't just focused on one area of change going on right now. Mm-hmm.
And with the themes, like the eight that you mentioned, that are kind of overarching things to think about, right, concepts, do you feel that the pandemic accelerated our thinking process and realizing some of these things and how quickly the things are evolving and changing?
For sure. I mean, there's a number. So we did work similar to this just over 2 years ago, actually. And so it's really interesting looking back on that work and really realizing how much has changed since then. And so, you know, things we talked about 2 years ago, we had highlighted a change and a trend that we wanted to highlight called digital detox, because at the time we were seeing a lot of people kind of adopting dumb phones or, you know, canceling their internet services and really saying, you know, I don't want to have so much technology connection. And obviously that has completely shifted with now such a focus on having connectivity and actually it being critical for many people to be able to work or even go to school right now. And so we did see quite a bit of an acceleration in some of the areas that we looked at a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people would have wanted, hey, I want to go home and disconnect from work. And now it's a bit totally different story to do that or play things that you thought we're going to do more ordering in or doing that with groceries and products as the years go on and see places, bricks and mortar maybe disappear. And the pandemic accelerated so many things. So would you say that we can expect to see some of these innovations soon or are we already?
Well, I think so. I definitely think that one of the important things that many people are experiencing right now is just the remote work environment. And we actually engaged a lot of about 50 experts as part of this work to ask their opinion too about the implications of some of these changes. And they also brought remote work up as something that we really need to pay attention to. I mean, not everyone is able to work remotely right now. But for the people that are working remotely, it has caused so much change in the way that things happen on a day-to-day basis. And we've seen that companies have announced, even last spring, announced that they weren't planning to go back to an office. And more recently, Salesforce has said, you know, the 9-to-5 is dead and they're going to keep many people remote even when things are safe to go back to an office environment. And as part of our research, we also found that there's a program in place in Estonia where you could be a digital resident and access some of the government services in Estonia without actually living there. And so it really, there are so many implications to some of the changes going on. But for this one, it seems like we're moving towards such a global workforce where there will be such an emphasis on new services that might support virtual collaboration and support innovation for remote teams working together going forward.
Yeah, and it's one that we've talked about a lot, right, Heather, working from home, staying working from home, or what it looks like for a lot of people, because there's so many angles for bigger conversations around productivity and people's mental health and well-being and things like that for the opportunities of working from home. Is there anything else you want to mention for implications and changes and things kind of evolving into something different than what we've known before the pandemic and it actually lasting through the decade?
Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the mega trends that we highlight or themes in the report is called capitalism in question. And I find this one personally really interesting to think about. We did highlight some of the changes around how, you know, there could be more attention paid to a universal basic income. You know, that was being discussed quite a bit last year as we're really trying to deal with the implications of the pandemic. And so, I mean, I don't know if that's actually going to come to pass or not, but if it did, it would have such a big implication on so many people in terms of providing more protection and supports for all workers across across many different demographics. And even, you know, there's a trend that we highlight that is more of a weak idea. So I don't know, I really don't know if it'll become more dominant in the future, but perhaps there'll be some new ways to think about economic progress in the future, you know, not only focusing on economic growth at all costs, but really thinking about some of the other implications in terms of economic goals and well-being goals, and really trying to pay more attention to that. So I think it'll be interesting to pay attention to many of these changes going forward.
I totally agree. Lots of things to think about. Heather, where can we go for more information and to check out the report ourselves?
For sure. If you go to the website, brookfieldinstitute.ca, you can find the report. Yesterday's gone. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We were speaking with Heather Russick, one of the lead authors of this report, Yesterday's Gone, and she was explaining some of the biggest trends driving Canada's labor market in the next decade.
In hour two, we have a meeting of our book club, and we'll kick things off with a community reporter. Julie Martin joins with us with her report. We'll be right back.
Knowing who's in the office just by hearing the typing style on their keyboard. Rough day, Matt? This is Kelly and Company on AMI Audio.
Welcome back. It's hour two of Kelly and Company. Rubya Muth and Kelly McDonald, hosts of the show, here weekdays from 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern, right here on AMI Audio. All right. On Tuesdays and on Thursdays, we get to do something really fun, Rum. We get to be nosy. We get to find out what's happening, how the other people live out there, man. We get to see what's going on around Canada when we check in with our community reporters. And today we're going to be joined by Julie Martin from Pictou County, Nova Scotia. Welcome back to the show. How are you, Julie?
I'm really good, guys. How are you too?
Hanging in. Can't complain. It's not good. Bad over at this end. Rum?
Well, you
I'm
know
doing
what?
Well, too. Only...
Good. You know what, Ramya? There's only 19 sleeps until we turn the clock forward.
Oh, geez. Thanks for reminding me.
And 27 sleeps, and it's the first day of spring. Come on.
Oh, wow.
Who's not excited about that? Like,
wow, now we are.
Well,
oh, I've got my seeds ready to go. I've got my plant pots ready. I've got my indoor greenhouse ready. Like, I'm... Aww. Very excited.
I don't think Julie bothers
it
with the groundhog.
No.
You got your own calendar. No. You just like go by the calendar and just say, forget it. This is when it's going to be. Well, what if there's a blizzard out right then? Doesn't matter. It's still that change.
Doesn't matter. Yeah.
Julie...
I always go with in like a lion, out like a lamb for March. So that's what I'm looking for.
It doesn't matter if it's a big storm. No, that's just a bigger lamb. Julie, let's talk about the Blind Tennis Club challenge that's going on.
Yes, tennis, anybody. So blind tennis was started in 1984 in Japan, and it's now played in over 30 countries worldwide. And I am thrilled that New Glasgow is the latest blind tennis club in Canada. So tennis is my game. I love tennis. However, I have to say, playing with these audible tennis balls is very, very different. They bounce differently. They're not as heavy. So it's a new experience for me. So I'm really enjoying it. We have tennis rackets, audible tennis balls, and blindfolds because this is a reverse integration sport. So anybody can play, no matter their visual, you know, whether they've got vision or not. Mm-hmm. But it has to be a level playing field. So if somebody with vision is going to play with me, they need to put on some adaptive goggles or blindfolds. So we're starting now. You can check the tennis balls out, take them home, the rackets, everything, and start practicing, because Veronica Dino, that started this, the recreation director in New Glasgow, has been in contact with the other three blind tennis clubs in Canada. There's Montreal, Toronto, Coquitlam, and then now New Glasgow. And all four of them are working on a fun and COVID-friendly contest between the four clubs.
So how will this work?
That is, they've got some kind of drills that they've got set up, and it's basically a matter of, you know, they're still working on the finer details, but it's things like, you know, how many times can you bounce the ball on the racket, forehand, right, backhand, on the floor, off the floor? Because it's all indoors right now. We're doing it at home, so it's not like we can get out onto a court. Although there is talk of maybe doing something on inside courts, but it depends on the restrictions in the other three provinces, right?
Yeah.
So, mm-hmm. I mean, we're all right. We're pretty good, but not so much in other provinces. So unfortunately, I don't have too many details on the contest right now. So watch this space. I'm kind of hoping that the community reporters in those areas might want to take up a little separate challenge for community reporters' bragging rights with AMI.
Yep, I like it.
Kind of thing. So
I
like it too. So we'll see how that goes. But in the meantime, anybody in the Pictou County area, if you're interested, call Veronica Dino at 902-755-8363, or you can email her at recreation.ns.ca to get the equipment you to loan and start practicing, so we can get bragging rights for New Glasgow instead of the other three provinces.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We'll put that up on the blog, ami.ca/Kelly Cohen. Rumya and I, if you get all the community reporters involved, of course we can't pick a favorite, but we'll root them all on, Rum.
Yes.
Of course you will. You have to.
Yeah, and we can do a little competition of our own. We get pretty competitive out here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know, I do too, unfortunately, but it's more about the fun as I'm getting older.
Yes, you and the quiz. And besides that, Julie, in all fairness, Rumi and I have to admit, we did kind of have a competition a couple of years ago, and we did our tryouts week, and, you know, yeah. I guess Rumi is up for losing again.
I won.
So,
and Julie, you couldn't accept it.
Move on to the second. And that poor lady's waiting. She doesn't want to hear your fairy tales.
All right. Okay, so in order to keep the peace, let's talk about Yak Tracks.
Yes, this is another one of the amazing Miss Veronica's initiatives. She purchased 15 pairs of yak tracks for people to loan free of charge again. So for those listeners that don't know what a yak track is, it's kind of like a silicone rubber band that slips over the bottom of your shoe, whatever shoe you're wearing. And then it's like a web of steel coils. So you're very sure-footed on snow and ice. You don't have to worry about slipping or falling. They're used by the military and outside construction workers and, you know, in icy conditions and stuff. And I really like mine. I've had them for several years. So I'm really happy that she did this, because people can try them or just have them if they want to go for the occasional walk with their family or friends, or, you know, check them out, realize you really like them, and go buy a pair of your own. Because they go on anything. I wear them on my rubber boots, whatever I've got on my feet, right? So they work great. And again, you can call Veronica at 902-755-8363 or email at recreation.newglasgow.ca.
So this is great because it's not just for, you know, winter sports and playing, like that's the first thing that comes to mind, but it's very practical for anyone who's outdoor all day.
Yeah. I mean, even going out to my recycling bin, you know, like I slip them on my slippers on my Crocs, because You know, you just never know. Like when you can't see if there's any ice there, I don't want to take the chance.
No. Okay.
Especially in Nova Scotia where we keep getting these lovely ice storms. Oh.
Yeah.
Your so last
my third,
item. Yo, yeah, that's okay. I was also to tee this up for you. The Coast Performing Arts Center in Pictou, Nova Scotia, and a tribute to Neil Young.
Yes. So the DeCoste Performing Arts Center, again, first of its kind in Nova Scotia, has volunteers that are trained to be vocalized, like the Vocalize program. So you don't have to worry about going somewhere on your own because you can't navigate the space or whatever. There's people there to help. And tickets go on sale this Thursday, the 25th. They do tend to sell out quite quickly at the DeCoste. But the show is March 26th, and if that sells out, they're having one March 27th. And if that sells out, they're going to live stream it. So the last time they did that, we had people from other countries that used to live in Pictou County that hopped on and enjoyed the show. So that's really nice. And for that, you call the DeCoste Centre at 902-485-8828. And again, those tickets go on sale on Thursday.
Oh, that sounds like a lot of fun. Are you a fan?
Yeah, Cinnamon Girl. I love that song.
Really? How about his newer stuff?
Yeah. I do tend to like older stuff, though. Like, I like the Beatles.
Right, right. Yep.
Like, that whole kind of genre of music. I don't mind his newer stuff, but I still like my, maybe it's because I'm getting old and it reminds me of my youth when I hear songs like that. I like the older stuff.
Makes the body feel better, right? It's like, I feel younger hearing that. I get a kick out of him because, you know, he being Canadian and he's now lives in the United States, but he's very vocal about political stuff and that in the United States. And I've gotten quite a chuckle and never was a huge fan myself personally, but I love so many of these Canadians like Neil Young who have gone out there and just kind of put the fact that Canada is where I'm from and put us kind of on the shoulder, and people say, oh yeah, he's Canadian, right? And people who have loved the music and recognized him.
Yeah, for sure. No, it's awesome when people remember the roots, for sure.
Oh, it's amazing. Julie, a lot of great stuff. Thank you kindly. Appreciate it. And we'll be putting it up, first of all up on the blog, ami.ca/Kelly Co. Any of the things the community reporters speak about here on the program so that people have easy access. And we'll talk to you next month.
Yes. Thank you, guys. Stay safe.
Julie Martin, our community reporter in Pictou County, Nova Scotia, as mentioned, ami.ca/Kelly Co. We're going to take a break, ladies and gentlemen. Lucia Belafonte and her son, Richard Thomas, are here to discuss transportation priorities for blind and low vision people. We'll talk to them in a moment. In Western Canada, TELUS has AMI audio on channel 889 and Westman subscribers channel 889 as well. Visit ami.ca/schedules for a list of channel locations in your area. Ramya Muth and Kelly McDonald welcoming you back to Kelly and Company.
Once a month on Tuesdays, we like to have a very real and thought-provoking conversation surrounding parenting with Lucia Belafonte.
Are you ready to learn, laugh, and maybe even cry a little? I'm Lucia Belafonte. Thanks for joining me on Kelly & Company, where both kids and parents can expect to grow in confidence and courage.
Lucia, looking forward to today's conversation with you as well, because we have a very special guest joining you on the show today.
Yes, we do. I feel like such a proud mom. My son, Richard Thomas, is joining our conversation today.
Hey, Richard Thomas. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Awesome. Did mom make you blush there? Like that kind of like, you know, because moms will do that.
Earlier when she told me, yes.
Right. Well, glad to have you with us, Richard Thomas.
Like I said, real conversations on the parenting segment. So this is, we're going to get into something kind of surrounding us talking in the last few weeks and maybe over a month about driver's licenses and how us as people with low vision or people who are blind go through the conversations and phases throughout life of not having a driver's license and the conversations that come up around that.
Yes, absolutely. We're going to continue that conversation because when I was speaking with Richard Thomas, it actually came about quite organically. An issue that, you know what, it had escaped my mind. But I'll let him explain later.
Mm-hmm. Well, we kind of got into it too, Richard Thomas, when a couple weeks ago on during our Back to Basics week. Can you tell us a little bit about you, sir?
Yes. Yeah. Right now I'm enrolled full-time at Niagara College for electrical engineering technician, and I'm doing the program online, as everyone is. And it's quite a bit easier than when I was doing it in person.
And why is that? Why is it easier?
Yeah. Without having to get to school where I was previously living, the bus would come once an hour to get to the college, and that was, well, an issue. Made it very inflexible for when I could pick classes, when I could get to school. And if it was early or late, I just miss a class.
Well, that doesn't sound very practical. I know that this is a big conversation that a lot of us have when it comes to choosing commuting to school or living on residence, right? That's a conversation that I had a lot with my parents. I'm like, I know it's in Toronto, but I don't want to commute 2 hours and I don't want to miss buses and classes and things like that.
And they said, tough.
Yeah. Mm. And then I moved anyway.
I know. Oh, sorry. I'm going to apologize for our dog. Of all days, I don't have the person who's usually here who takes him out of the house when we're on air. So please forgive us, but we're real.
It's okay. He's learned lessons from Rumya's dog.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness gracious. But you know, you're right. Well, someone saying tough is annoying. I mean, yes, we have to do what we have to do. But I'll let Richard Thomas share how he actually felt and how it impacted his learning when he was missing the bus. Go ahead, my dear.
Thank you. Having a bus nearby was great because it meant I could actually get around if I had to go somewhere for the day. But for school specifically, it meant I had one route that came, as I said, once an hour. And that's just not feasible for taking a program in college. You don't have enough time. If you miss the bus, you miss the class. And there's no flexibility there. Classes have to be taken around a bus schedule.
Right.
And it is tough because people expect, hey, how come, you know, other students have to do the same thing, and it's really, really tough. And Lucia, you've had students talk to you about this in the past for their own courses and stuff like that too, haven't you?
Yes, absolutely. You know, we'd have so many conversations towards the end of their high school career in preparation for, like, you know, going on to college, university, or life. And it was frustrating because you're absolutely right, Kelly. Everyone is stuck if they're taking public transportation and the bus only comes once an hour. So you need to accommodate and strategize for that. But sometimes what the general public forgets is that it's not just about having those orientation and mobility skills and having accessibility to public transportation, right? Because a route might seem feasible to a person who's sighted, but then if you're blind or partially sighted, that same route is, boy, oh boy, is it a challenge. And sometimes not even practical at all.
Mm-mm. And I also find routes, when you think about it, Unfortunately, transit is often looked at more of a business than we'd like it to be. So therefore, if the other people who have options of borrowing dad's car, buying a car, doing other things, carpooling with somebody, no one's using that bus. So then there's going to be less service, which puts those of us who need it, who have no other choice, in jeopardy.
Oh my gosh, absolutely true. I've often thought there has to be a better solution. There really does.
Yeah. And it's when we think about traveling independently, you know, we toss that around a lot, right? Because I remember when I was younger, I had this overarching aim to travel independently one day. I want to be able to do that. But what does that mean for you as an individual? And how does that get affected depending on where you live and what you need to go to? Like, school's one example, work is another, right? If you can't necessarily have the option of traveling independently to these places and it's part of your daily life, then it becomes a struggle.
You know, you're absolutely right. And I'm going to extend that even further to where my conversation with Richard Thomas stemmed from. Is he was talking to me about wanting to hurry up and finish school and buying a house. And I said, what for? And then, Richard Thomas, I'm going to let you chat a little bit about this and you share.
Thank you. My intent is to finish school quickly so I can get a house as fast as I can, because having low vision means where I can live in relation to where I work is limited. A lot of other good options, because I don't need much, and if I'm living alone, they're available to me, having a trailer, living on a boat, all of those which I could do if they coincidentally were near where I worked. Otherwise, I need a house or I need to rent somewhere. If I'm renting, I'm spending money and not moving forward as the price of housing increases. So it's much better for me to just have the money to get a place near where I work, save enough so I can buy a house right off the bat, and then find a way to mitigate the cost, either through renting part of it or some other business on the side, just because of how big an issue it is to travel to work.
Yeah. Exactly. So all of that stuff kind of stems from, I guess it's kind of a cycle, right, Richard Thomas? Like, you're not really looking for a home unless you found where your work is, or vice versa. Like, you're kind of trying to make it fall under one package.
Yes, where I live is entirely dependent on where I work.
That's it. Yeah.
If I happen to work in the middle of the city, not much, because public transit is dense. Anywhere else, Canada is large. That doesn't exist.
And it's interesting, because of the priorities, you have to put it in place. So to get to work 5 days a week or whatever it might be, might compromise you on Sunday when there's no bus because of where you have to live.
Yeah.
Right. Absolutely. And so, you know, then you talk about trying to get creative with solutions, and sometimes they're not practical. You might not have someone that you can get that could drive you there. And we talked a little bit last month about taking a taxi and where that's a great idea. But if it's costing $160 one way, which is not unreasonable. That's an hour and a half drive. I just did that a couple of months back. That's why I know. I mean, how practical is that? $160 one way.
Yeah. And if you're working with people, and even if someone says, well, I can help you out, I can give you a ride, you're dependent on that person, which makes you feel like it goes back to as if you sat down for the interview and the boss said, we're out in the country. How are you getting in? Well, I can take transit. I can do this and that. You know, the last thing they want to hear you say is, well, I can maybe find a coworker that will, what?
Yeah. It's that idea of being independent. I know, Richard Thomas, we've talked about this often too, how you feel frustrated because you want to be far more independent than you sometimes are.
Yes, there's a lot of things that you don't have the opportunity to just get around. Yeah, when you're low vision and can't drive somewhere, you just can't do that. And again, even if I find a job and work somewhere that I like, if I wanted to change jobs, I now have to move to where I'm working again.
Mm, true. It's not just a matter of, it might not be the issue of taking a different route or taking the, public transportation. We're not even talking about an hour. Sometimes it's just not feasible. However, this is such a serious conversation.
Well, it is. And I feel like it's very reflective of a lot of our lives, people who are used to commuting. I know that's not necessarily mm-hmm. specific to people who are blind or low vision, but yeah. it can be, right? And I have a lot of sighted friends who don't drive either and face this very similar circumstances where they're like, okay, well, it's either a 2-hour commute for me to get to this dream job, or I have to move, or I have to keep looking. That's just kind of the reality for a lot of people.
Well, and the cost of where you want to live, where you want to have access to that transit, it's going to be more than that because people want it more and people are in that situation. There's going to be that area. So you're kind of stuck too, guys, because, yes, I need the transit, so I need to be where I can have it. Or if you're way out, then I need to live next door to work so I can get there on time for any shift or anything that comes my way, yeah. which precludes me from maybe my social life.
Oh my gosh, absolutely true. It's something that, we try to, well, as a parent, you try to raise your child and let them know that they can be as independent as possible, and that then whatever challenges come your way, you have to deal with them. There's no other option other than to deal with them. But then the reality is that sometimes it can really affect the quality of life. And I think yes. that's what we're talking about, right? We want that quality of life to be as optimal as possible.
Exactly. And which brings me to the question, you talked about it at the intro of the segment. Mm-hmm. You were surprised at yourself for kind of quote unquote forgetting the need to be close to work, or what that's like, yeah. even as a parent with a child who has a disability. So what do you suggest? Like, what does that mean to you to consider that?
Right. Well, so considering that, and that this has been my career for 20 some odd years, and my son is now almost 25, so I really shouldn't have forgotten. But it's just that sometimes, for me, it's you... Anyhow, I'm going to go off in a tangent. We don't have time. Basically, bottom line is parents really need to speak with their children. And from a very early age, have conversations, all sorts of conversations. They don't need to be about whether or not your child is blind or partially sighted. But just have that relationship with your child so that they're comfortable to speak openly and honestly with you, so that when there are obstacles to life, when there's challenges, when there are difficult decisions to be made, they know that they can count on you. They know that they can come to you and share with you openly and honestly whatever it is that is happening, so that, you can maybe either guide them or just be there for emotional and moral support. So I say talk, and talk some more.
Plus, there's that transportation fund you mentioned a while ago. Oh, I thought that was
yes,
a great idea,
that's
too.
That's right. Sorry. Yeah, I say start a transportation fund real early in life.
Real early.
Absolutely.
Yeah, real early. When they're born, never mind toys and gifts from all the aunts and uncles. Right? Some toys
they'll
are
understand
okay.
later. Richard there Thomas Lucia, thank you so much. We appreciate the conversation always.
Thank you for having me.
Take care.
That was our parenting talk with Lucia Belafonte and her son, Richard Thomas, and they were talking about driving. Well, lack of driving.
Yeah, a lot of the lack in our case. We discussed the 5 love languages from Dr. Gary Chapman on our book club meeting. We do this once a month. We'll get into the conversation after this. Welcome to the Kelly and Company Audio Book Club, folks. We know you've been waiting for it all month. This is our chance and yours to really get into the books, authors, and narrators that we either love or maybe not so love. Today, we're getting into the conversation of the book, The Five Love Languages. This is The Secret to Love That Lasts, written by Gary Chapman and recommended to us by Jeevan Baines. We'll bring Jeevan on just a moment and get into the conversations, but we've got a voicemail from Robert Just, who read another book along the same series, and this is The Five Love Languages by Gary Chapman and Ross Campbell, and we'll let him explain a little bit how these same love languages, which we'll get into in our conversation, apply. Here's Robert Just.
Hello again, Kelly and Company. Robert Just in Midtown Toronto. And this is in connection with the book of the month, The Five Love Languages of Children by Drs. Gary Chapman and Ross Campbell. It is my impression that these two psychologists have written this book as a parental handbook. And I'll proceed to explain. They outline the five love languages of children. And in chapter one, I like their description of how quality time worked in the case of Dennis and Brenda and their son Brent and his difficulties at school, and how quality child-parent time spent together remedied that rather questionable situation. And I look forward to the other reviews of this inspiring book. Thank you very much indeed.
Robert Just from Toronto giving us his comments on another book, of course, partnered up. But now let's get back to our book here that we've got, The Five Love Languages. And joining Ramya and I on the panel is Jeevan Baines. She is the recommender of this book. Jeevan, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with the concept of the five love languages is seemingly popular, and you could take online quizzes to get to know yours and your partner's languages. Now, had you heard about it, Jeevan, before diving into the book that you recommended? Did you hear quite a bit about it?
Yes, I'd heard about it over the years, and I thought maybe it's time for me to give it a read.
That's awesome. That's really, really cool. Ramya, this genre of writing, let's call it self-improvement, is topping the charts. We are always hearing people looking for one thing or another to get better about. Are you a fan of this?
I won't answer for this particular book, but yeah, in general, I am curious about this kind of genre with the self-improvement and people's perspectives on how to kind of make yourself better. But I don't always get through the books, Kels, if I'm being honest with you. Sometimes like the liner or the titles, because some of these titles are really, pumped, right? They grab me and then I start reading the books and then I'm like, oh, okay, I don't know if I can make it through. So there's a few of these unfinished books in my cart.
As we were talking about the other day with Ryan Huey on the program, get through the book. But unfortunately, sometimes I find, oh my goodness, I got to back up because the mind wanders. So, Jeevan, this book was released in 1992, almost three decades ago. Do you think the writing reflects that? Does it keep up with the times? Is it kind of that everlasting book that no matter when you read it, it's kind of applicable?
I think the concepts in it are definitely applicable around the five love languages and how people like to express and receive love. So what I do think is that has changed over time are the specific situations. So in this particular book, there might have been a focus on domestic roles within the house. I find nowadays there's more difference, like interracial couples. There's cultural differences, and society has also evolved too. So I feel like the concepts would still remain the same, but in terms of the specific examples that complement it have definitely changed over the years. I also think that these relationships could apply to how people communicate with their coworkers, with their roommates. So the book itself, written in 1992, was probably reflective of back then, and him being a marriage counselor, there was emphasis put on marriage and children.
Yeah. As we see from Robert's comments at the top and the love languages, the five love languages of children and subsequent other books too, this carries on. You can see the updating. And, you know, I really like what you said about culture. Ramya, you have some comments to read for us from Amr.
Yeah, exactly. And this is kind of touching on what you were saying as well, Jeevan. This is from Amr Khan. Despite the author's anthropological background, it's surprising to see so little on cultural, ethnic, or racial, aspects. We only see one sliver of this in the context of gifts with Fred, that was one of the examples from the book, and the stick he receives on the island of Dominica. So I kind of agree. I think that a lot of times throughout the book, as short as it was, and as direct as it is, Kels, I did feel that, yes, overall, I can get with the program. I can get with the concepts of, you know,
the languages themselves.
Speaking. Yeah. And speaking in somebody else's language, because it may not be the way that you speak is the way that they speak. Right. So I can get with that. But I did feel that I was looking for more cultural examples or something that felt a little bit more diverse and present day. And it did kind of feel that, okay, yeah, I had to keep reminding myself, okay, this was released 30 or so years ago, so it wouldn't be so, you know.
We had really the reflections of people in Canada, the United States, and as you guys both have pointed out, and Amr as well, that is definitely something that I wonder has if the subsequent books have been updated that way. So, Ramya, I have to wonder your tone of the book. What are your thoughts of it overall? You said short, so it was a reasonable read.
It was, and I got through it quite quickly, and there were never really at times when I was going, oh my gosh, move along, because it did move along very well and smoothly. I did find it, though, very, like, cut and dry, very black or white. You know, it's the, if you do this, it'll work, and over time, it will work, and if you follow the instructions, you should be able to, and all the examples correlated
worked
to that, right?
Yep.
Exactly. All the examples of these marriages that were falling to shambles, they would come to see Dr. Gary Chapman, and in his relaying to them the five love languages, they would come back years later at some of these examples and say, oh my gosh, you're a miracle worker. So mm-hmm. I did find it a bit of a hard sell in that case, you know, and it's not necessarily a take it or leave it type of book. It felt much more like a hard sell.
Oh yeah, I would have liked some of the process too, where when he says, no, don't ask after a week, after you've got feedback, then maybe ask for something a week later. Why a week? Why not 5? Why not 2 weeks? Jeevan, did you find that there was enough of those practical examples in the book, or were you looking for that maybe a couple that fell through, or as we've been mentioning, more of the other cultures?
I completely agree. I had actually read a more recent version of the book before reading this one. And so when I was reading it, I was actually comparing the two. And so I actually liked the newer one. I think it was 2004 it was published in,
yes,
which I thought that it did have better examples. And it also went into things like filling up your own love tank and kind of loving yourself and doing things to be kind to yourself. And it's not always about the other person, which I think is really important as well.
Yeah, I really think that, and again, going back to pointing out, this is for family, friends as well, that these things apply. And I think the leap off form was the children's book. But I wondered that when I kept seeing all the different ones, how far ahead, and I'm sure we'll see something else come up in time. So Jeevan, did it help you knowing your love language? Is it helpful to you?
It was really, really interesting. So when I took the quiz, my love language was, my primary one was quality time, and then my next highest was service. And when I had just done the quiz for fun without reading the books before, it was service. So I really started to think about, oh, I wonder what's shifted. Was it the mood that I was in when I was answering those questions that day? Or I was actually thinking about the pandemic and maybe quality time is really important to me now, just because there's many other things I can't do. So it's these virtual catch-ups with friends and family that I really appreciate. So.
Well, you do wonder if over time it would change. And, you know, as life goes on for a person, you know, what you find important as a child when you look at the children versus teenager versus young adult versus senior citizen, I would think they are going to change. Rum, you've got some comments.
Yeah, this one also from Amir. Overall, this is a book to be read with a grain of salt, but not a bag of it. I loved that line. And there's a lot you can learn from the practical exercises and suggested ideas. The book can certainly help your relationships, and in that, Chapman has achieved his goal. The overall concepts can be easily applied to friendship, children, or in the intended married couple. And in that way, it's more universal than for just married couples. And just to add on to that, from my perspective, I think that that's definitely true. Like what you both have been saying, it's more of a broad concept than before. And even I'm curious to read the books further along from this one, especially about filling your own love tank and things like that. Because I did have moments where I was like, how about if I didn't want someone else? If I could just speak my own love language to myself,
that'd be good to yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And also, I thought I had done the same thing. I'd done the quiz online. I felt that it was very rigid when I did one of the quizzes. And I thought, honestly, I feel like I have more than one primary love language. And then Gary, in his way of answering that question, you know, what if you think you have two primary love languages? And especially he was using it, for example, males thinking that physical touch is one of theirs, right? And I thought that those answers were just not sufficient enough for me. I felt like the dialects were important that he mentioned for each of these five love languages. There are multiple dialects. So that's super important. But I do think it can be more gray than that, like even more gray, where you feel like you're speaking multiple love languages.
Well, when you struggle with the gray, you know what you're supposed to do, ladies. Give Gary a call and pay $100 an hour to then he can color it in a little bit more for you. But I think, too, when you do it online, that the quiz, you got to make it simple enough. And I'm sure most people, and I think he says in the book, you know, you're going to find you're going to have one or two. And one's going to probably supersede the other. G-Man, thanks a lot for having the talk with us. Anything in closing quickly that you have on the book that you wanted to throw in here?
No, thank you for having me. And I'm looking forward to the discussion this evening at the book club.
Well, thank you for recommending, and we'll take a recommendation anytime. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
G-Fan Baines recommending the five love languages. Rum, we've got next month's book lined up here, so let's have a little chat about that. And it's called The Vanishing Half by Britt Bennett.
Exactly. This was released in 2020, so it's a pretty recent release. And it's recommended to us by our fashion contributor who joins us monthly on the show, Kia Osborne. It's a novel that, first of all, she's told me a bit about her perspectives on it, and she seems to really highly recommend it. So it's a novel about twin sisters, inseparable as children, who ultimately choose to live in two very different worlds, one white and one black. The Vignes twin sisters will always be identical, but after growing up together in a small southern black community and running away at age 16, it's not just the shape of their daily lives that's different as adults. It's everything. Their families, their communities, their racial identities. Even separated by so many miles and just as many lives, the fates of their twins being intertwined, remain intertwined. This book weaves together multiple strands and generations of this family, from the deep south to California, from the 1950s to the 1990s. And we're going to discuss this book in a month's time, a little bit like 5 weeks, because it's on Tuesday, March 30th. But looking forward to it.
Superb. Well, let's take a sample.
City living would tire them out. They'd run out of money and gall and come sniffling back to their mother's porch. But they never returned again. Instead, after a year, the twins scattered, their lives splitting as evenly as their shared egg. Stella became white, and Desiree married the darkest man she could find. Now she was back, Lord knows why. Homesick, maybe. Missing her mother after all those years, or wanting to flaunt that dark daughter of hers. In Mallard, nobody married dark. Nobody left either. But Desiree had already done that. Marrying a dark man and dragging his blue-black child all over town was one step too far.
Awesome. Vanishing Half, That's next month's book right here on the Kelly and Company Book Club, available via Audible and also available on Sela. So do check it out, ladies and gentlemen. If you wish to, like G-Van, suggest a book to us, give us a call, 1-866-509-4545. We'd love to hear from you. Suggest that it's for the Kelly and Company Book Club. Tell us a little bit about why you're recommending it, who you are, and hopefully you can join us as part of the panel when we discuss the book. Feedback at AMI.ca, if that's a bit better for you to make the recommendation. But again, we'd love to hear your voice. 1-866-509-4545. That's our book club for this month. Thank you for being with us for it. Why don't you hang in, folks? We'll wrap up our show, tell you what's coming up tomorrow on it, and also preview Now with Dave Brown. We'll be right back. Kelly and Company with Ramya Muth and Kelly McDonald. Remember, check out the Kelly and Company podcast where you can hear the complete show. Today, an audio vanity card from Jeff Ryman, our producer on the program, is also included. A fun cat story, I will say. And it's fun because it was funny. And a bit of a destructive cat story. If you were listening to the network earlier in the day during the Gazette, you already have a tip-off to what happened. But there's a little more background. So do check out the complete Kelly and Company podcast, as well as segments of the show, if that's a little bit more convenient for you. Some of the time we don't have a whole bunch of time, so subscribe, give us a rating and review. Rum, want to look at a segment or two to call out to?
Yes, a few great segments today, but I think the one that I'll be doing more research on after leaving the show is float tanks with Frances Wong. And she talked about, well, first of all, the huge transformation of float tanks, what they were in the 50s when they first came out to now. In my opinion, they're two completely different concepts, but, you know, they merged off of each other. And just an interesting way to kind of spend your time. It's a lot of psychological benefits as well as the physical benefits she talked about.
We had Heather Rusek on here earlier to talk about a report about how things are going to look in the next decade when it comes to work. I thought it was very, very interesting. I think we could have gone some other places with it a little bit with her just to kind of get more of the concept of it. But boy, folks, do you ever get some insight as to some of the areas they went, eight of these areas that really give you an idea of what the viewpoint now that we've been going through this pandemic, how it's going to affect the look of work and some of the things that we need, whether it's working from home or what offices not necessarily will look like, but the experience that you'll be having, that'll all be coming up. So really cool thing to take a look at. You can find that on the Kelly and Company podcast. Simply subscribe. And if you wouldn't mind, give us a rating and review. Other programs like The Pulse, excellent show from this past weekend, a really interesting special they've got, and other programs like The Walrus, Voices of the Walrus to check out. Paul Daniel joins us. He's one of the producers on Now with Dave Brown. Sir, welcome to the show. What's coming up tomorrow at 9 a.m. in the morning Eastern?
Hey, Kelly. Hey, Ramya.
Hey, Paul.
On tomorrow's show, we'll talk with Dwayne Gibson, the creator of Black Canadian 365, on the need to keep discussing the stories and history of Black Canadians beyond the month of February. Tech expert Mike Agarbo from the App Show will tell us the reason why graphics card maker NVIDIA is deliberately reducing the efficiency of its latest card by 50%. And Virgin political correspondent Craig Oliver discusses the online bilateral meeting between Prime Minister Trudeau and U.S. President Joe Biden, which is taking place later today.
Awesome, Paul. Some really good conversation and looking forward to that. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Kelly.
That starts at 9 a.m. in the morning. Also available via podcast. If by chance you can't be there, that's the Now with Dave Brown program. Paul Daniel, one of the producers, just leaving us. You know, Rum, we know that this is Black History Month. We've had some conversations on the show, and what Paul said, and going back to the five love languages, you do wonder a lot about those conversations we have to keep having. After we explore a lot of the cool things we're hearing about in Black history, some of the not so cool things that we know about, but really keeping conversations about all cultures and learning about people, the cultures and things, it goes very far to helping us all get along.
Yeah, exactly. And in the context of getting along, it really is. If there's something broadly that I've taken away from the Five Love Languages book is that, you know, just because I do something or hear something or say something a certain way, it doesn't mean that it comes off that way to somebody else, right? And really, we just we're trying to speak to each other and understand each other in the ways that we want to be heard, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's the way that we speak.
Understanding people and willing to understand our differences is so important. And it sounds so simple because all you got to do really is listen and be empathetic. But sometimes it's a tough one because we try to rationalize so much out. Why is that done? Why do you think that way? Why is that in your culture? And sometimes we just have to really try to empathize with each other and really actually listen for real. Thanks, Rum.
Thank you.
On the program tomorrow, when we begin at 2 p.m. Eastern, Greg David, he's back to talk about the official Golden Globe nominations as the awards are coming up this weekend. The next episode of Tales from the Halifax School for the Blind podcast is out next week, and Ryan Delahanty, he arrives to give us a sneak preview. We have the Wednesday edition of Buzz with Bill. Also, the Oakville Festivals of Film and Art are celebrating International Women's Day all month long with the launch of the International Women's Day film series. We'll learn more with their PR manager and our friend of the show, Colleen McCourt. Tomorrow, we're going to also be talking with Mary Mammoliti about quarantine food trends and everything that's gone viral during the pandemic. And producer Jeff Ryman, he's here with the latest health headlines. We get started at 2 p.m. Eastern. Hope you'll be here for it or listen on the podcast here on Kelly and Company. I'm waving at you. Have a great night.
What's up, guys? It's Jeff Ryman here, and boy, do I have a story for you. Over the weekend, my girlfriend and I, we ventured out to Port Hope, Ontario to adopt a new friend to our family. We adopted a 10-month-old long-haired tuxedo cat. So he's 10 months old and is black with a little bit of white on his face and a little bit of white on his chest. And he was rescued from an abandoned house about 2 weeks ago. So he's still pretty much wild and not yet domesticated. And he is really shy. He's a complete sweetheart. He's basically shown no aggressiveness. He's not attempted to bite us nor hiss. He just likes to chill and sort of be in a little corner by himself. And I'm sure he'll warm up over time. But right now he's still a little bit timid and a little bit shy. But apparently, at night, he likes to get into a little bit of mischief. So currently, I have him set up in my office, which is just a spare bedroom. It's not very big. We have a scratch post. We've got tons of toys. We've got his bed. His multiple beds, actually. Lots of hiding places. But this morning, when I tried to do my hit on the Gazette for sports, I was running into a bit of microphone problems. I was thinking, oh my goodness, what's going on? Checked every single computer setting imaginable, and still, no cigar. I couldn't figure out what was going on with my mic. And then I realized, and I looked down at my headphone cord, and it was chewed. It was chewed by our little furry friend, Simon. And he decided to chew not just one, but two pretty large holes in the line, or in the wire, I should say. And that's exactly what the problem was. So I quickly switched headsets and was able to get on air. But, you know, comes off as shy, comes off as timid, but looks like he's a little bit of a troublemaker when he's left alone at night.
You've been listening to the complete Kelly and Company podcast experience.
The Real Deal airs weekday from 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern on AMI Audio. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast platform.